Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester with me, Clint Boone. Every week we'll be celebrating the spirit of Manchester by speaking to somebody who's helped shape the city. This week I'm joined by the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham. He's going to tell us about growing up at the other end of the M62 and causing trouble as a teenager.
I feature in the book Fever Pitch by Nick Hornby because he complains in it about how Highbury was never used for FA Cup semi-finals after some stupid Everton fans ran on the pitch in 1984, and hands up, I was one of them.
And he'll also talk about his favourite Manchester musicians.
Stone Roses, it feels to me that they're just timeless and they're for every man.
My guest today, a man who for the last 18 months or so has held the position of Mayor of Greater Manchester, and amongst other things, he's made it part of his mission to address the city's homelessness problem. And he also played a vital part in helping the city and its people through the months following the arena tragedy of May 2017. Andy Burnham, welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester.
Thanks very much, Clint. It's great to be back.
Nice to have you back. Are you still enjoying the job then?
Do you know what, Clint? I'm loving it. You know, I've not spent a minute where I think, oh, I wish I was back in Westminster. You know, I feel so privileged to be doing the job in a city, in a region like the one that we live in. You know, the support I'm getting from people is great. I just hope I can repay it. I believe in this place, in the north of England, always have done. I've long felt that the way the country's run isn't fair to the north. And in my own little way now, I'm trying to do something about that and even things up and get our voice heard a bit more, you know, really make sure that, you know, never do we get decisions taken where people are just kind of riding roughshod over us, as we all know, as has happened in the past.
Absolutely. I think that's why the city's embrace you, though, because you're a very rare thing. You're a politician who seems to be doing it for the right reasons, like the love of people, the love of the city that you represent, and that's why we've all embraced you. It's a rare thing.
Nice to say that. I mean, I was obviously in politics for a long time, as you said, and was in a government in the Labour years, and I kind of, if I'm honest, went on a bit of a personal journey through those years. You know, I kind of, you know, at one point you're in young, you're trying to get on and you build your career. You know, things I started to question, and I suppose it all came to a head in 2009 when I went back to my city of my birth for the anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster. And I knew that day, as somebody from the Northwest, I had nothing to say to the people there, and I knew the government I was in hadn't done anything for them. And, you know, in terms of the journey I've been on, Clint, that, I suppose, was the kind of moment of, you know, really quite profound change.
I was going to say profound is a word that popped right up in my head then, so... Yeah, that's a quite life-changing moment, isn't it, for you as a politician and for the city as well, obviously, Liverpool. Let's go back to the beginning, Emma, because a lot of what we're talking about on these podcasts is the stories behind people, you know, all started where they were born, how they did at school. I know that you were a bit of a sporty kid. We're going to touch on that in a minute too. But first of all, tell us where and when you were born, Andy.
So I was born on the 7th of January, 1970, so I just made it into the 70s. In Keeble Drive in the Old Roan in Aintree. So that's hard to admit when you're the Mayor of Greater Manchester. But yeah, I was born down the other end of the M62.
Yeah.
So my dad Scouser through and through, got a job in Manchester in the early 70s, a place called Dial House in Salford. So he was working for the old post office, which became British Telecom. And he had to kind of uproot from Liverpool, and they decided to go halfway, and grew up in the Lee area. But then all my years were here, really, Clint. So, you know, people will always say to me, oh, you know, Scouse, whatever. But to be honest, it's only really football that was my Liverpool connection. Most of my formative years were spent in these streets.
And what did your mum do for a job?
So my mum was a telephone receptionist, and she met my dad at a telephone exchange, and then later on became a GP's receptionist. You know, was in and out of work a bit. So they mean everything to me, my mum and dad. They've backed me all the way. They still do.
And still around, yeah?
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. And we're just such a close family. And all the things that I've done in life, they've always been behind me. And it's just the way they've encouraged me to see the world is all down to them, to be honest.
And was politics a big thing in the family back then when you were a child? Because you joined the Labour Party when you were 14 or something, didn't you?
I know, it's quite young. People must think I was, you know, a real geek or something. But maybe I was. But no, it was, to be honest, it was the experience of living through the 80s. Yeah. My earliest political memory is watching Boys from the Black Stuff with my mum and dad, and starting to ask a lot of questions. You know, why is there people? Is that really what people are going through? And then go forward a few years to the miners' strike. Well, in the Lee area, that was quite a big thing because it was in front of us.
Yeah.
So I remember being at school with lads whose dads were out on strike, and you know, we all had to bring food in and stuff. And that again was a big thing. And that's around the time that I then got politically active. My mum and dad weren't activists or councillors or anything like that. You know, they were just Labour voters, but nothing more than that.
Yeah, but always keen to discuss with you the state of the world and state of things. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think for me, the thing that, if you like, radicalised me was Hillsborough. You know, when that happened, some of the events of the 80s have been kind of close, but not completely close. You know, so Moss Side, Toxteth, the miners' strike, they were kind of near, but not very, very near.
Mm.
But then Hillsborough obviously was people I knew, people I was at school with, and yeah, that was then the kind of end of a long, difficult decade, wasn't it? And that then pushed me into actively wanting to devote my life to politics.
Let's go back to your childhood, Andy. How did you get on at school? I believe you're a bit of a sporty child, weren't you?
I was always, you know, pretty good at school. So I was top-ish of the class, I have to say, in most things, until I got to secondary school, which was in Newtonley Willows, Catholic school. And kind of fell in with the kind of wrong crowd, you know, tried to be one of the lads and very much sort of lost my way in those middle years. And right. I remember a teacher saying to me once that, you know, I'd got in the O level set by the skin of my teeth. And if you don't change, you're gonna not fulfill your potential. And that was a big kind of moment where I kind of regained my kind of focus a bit.
So how rebellious were you then? Can you give us any anecdote?
Fairly. Yeah, I wasn't a kind of a goody two-shoes kind of, you know, the odd scrape at school. And we used to, it's interesting because we used to go to school, as I say, in Newtonley Willow. So we were St. Aylred's, and up the road was a school called Selwyn Jones. And who would go to Selwyn Jones but somebody called Rick Astley? So he was involved in a band, which were largely based at our school, and he used to come in and out all the time. But the thing with that was, St. Aylred's and Sellies, as they were called, there was really no getting on at all. And this was a source of a lot of friction. So on the high street in Newton at lunchtime, there was, I have to admit to have been involved in a few of those difficult things.
Yeah.
And my claim to fame always was from growing up is I feature in the book Fever Pitch by Nick Hornby, because he complains in it about how Highbury was never used for FA Cup semi-finals after some stupid Everton fans ran on the pitch in 1984, and hands up, I was one of them.
Was it on the telly?
I'll tell you the story about that, because I was there. I got on a coach, and it had come from Ashton and Makerfield. We just get the Eveway coach all the way down, and you know, Adrian Heath scores this goal. You know, I was straight over the wall, straight on the pitch, and my dad and we travel back. Off the coach, this would have been about like 12 o'clock. My dad's like, oh, you have a good day? You know, yeah, it's brilliant. Dad, yeah. You behave yourself? Yeah. You sure? Yeah. So that wasn't you on Match of the Day on the pitch.
So you being born in 1970, I reckon that the punk scene was probably the first music that really affected you.
It was. At primary school, punk was massive for us. You know, we did. We were really into it. We all had the Sex Pistols EP. Was it an EP? Well, it was called Friggin' in the Riggin', wasn't it? And everyone had it.
Yeah, yeah.
You remember that? You used to have to hide it from your mum in case your mum found it and played it. And, so I bought that. I had Clash singles, but I did go down to the record shop in a little place called Cultureth where I grew up. There used to be a little record shop. And I remember picking up this single. Had like a love art on the front, Ever Fallen in Love, the Buzzcocks. I'd heard it on Top of the Pops, immediately loved it. But it was in the early, then mid-80s, me and my brother started to pick up from what was going on over here, and we started to come into Manchester more and more and really kind of caught the wave, I think, Clint, is the best way to describe it. You know, I can remember going into Piccadilly Records and picking up Hatful of Hollow and buying it and coming back on the bus to Lee with it and reading all the notes and everything. And yeah, I can remember that very vividly. So I was lucky, really, to be in and around the city in that era.
Let's talk about modern Manchester actor that you do love, the Quartinas. You're a big fan of the Quartinas, aren't you?
Oh, I am, yeah. You know, I've seen them, saw them at Heaton Park and then again at the Old Trafford. I think they're brilliant. I think they're underplayed, really, and underrated, actually. I mean, you know, the following they've got here shows how good they are.
It's phenomenal, isn't it?
It is phenomenal. And for me, they're the band of this generation that is most like the bands that we had in the 80s and 90s. So they're kind of something, you know, that is galvanising people behind them and, you know, create these events that are major events. I really, you know, I think Liam writes brilliant songs. I think he's a fantastic lyricist as well. And they're a true Manchester band for me in every sense of the word.
Have you got a favourite Quartinas track?
Take Over the World, because...
Beautiful.
I'll just tell you a quick anecdote about it. When I was standing to be leader of the Labour Party in 2015... I was listening to it on a train when I was travelling to an event, and the lyric came on, you know, I'm only a paper boy from the Northwest, but I can scrub up well in my Sunday best. And I tweeted this, and it kind of got a bit of pickup at the time, I remember rightly, because I was a paper boy once.
Did you do your paper round? Yeah.
I did indeed. And it kind of fitted where I was at that time in my life. So, I always look back at that. It was in that 2015 moment, this song was kind of very much the forefront of my life.
Who's your favourite band of all time, Andy?
Oh, well, it's the Stone Roses. So for me, you know, I was very much into the Smiths in the mid to late 80s. I had the Morrissey haircut and all of that. But then I was just getting through university and I just remember first hearing I Want to Be Adored. I'd got on John Peel, I think it was, and I was listening to it on my Walkman, as we used to have in the old days, peddling around Cambridge at university. And I just thought, hang on a minute, this is something different. And it brought everything together for me. There were a bit of Beatles there, and it was the kind of record I'd waited all my life to hear, I think. And I can remember it vividly, first hearing that first Stone Roses album. And I came back from university, and I was working at on Portland Street, at British Telecom on Portland Street. I think it's called One Manchester these days, that building. And I used to go down in my lunch hour to Piccadilly Records every day. That's how I used to spend my whole lunch hour. And those were the days where it wasn't just the albums. They had a little booth in the corner that was selling tickets for gigs. And I remember looking up and seeing Empress Ballroom, 12th of August, 1989. Bought the tickets there and then. Three tickets for me and my brothers. And that for me, that night at Blackpool, I will never forget that. That was... The main experience I had in my life of being part of something that was happening, and it was really, but it being there at the start of it, I suppose, rather than, you know, being a kind of Johnny come lately. You know, for me, that record and the Stone Roses, as I've gone on, they've never dated for me. The Smiths have kind of veered in and out at times. I've liked them, then I've not liked them, and it's partly linked to what Morrissey kind of comes out of his mouth. But I mean, you know, but I've had a bit of that relationship with the Smiths. With the Stone Roses, it feels to me that they're just timeless and they're for every man. Whereas the Smiths, they always had a bit of a sense of, oh, if you're a bit, you know, intelligent and university, you'll like the Smiths. And you use the Smiths to kind of separate yourselves from other people. Whereas the Stone Roses never had that feel to them. They were just for everybody. And they kind of brought all comers together. And that's what I loved about them.
Talk about sport. You're into your cricket and football. I think you still play football, don't you?
I do. I play five-a-side every Monday night. Right. I just think it's really important. Not just for physical health, for your mental health as well. You know, it's just good to be with your brothers and your mates, and so I still do that. But yeah, I was okay footballer. I was forced to play a bit of rugby league growing up, but my main sport was cricket. Yeah. I was a pretty good cricketer, so I was a Lancashire schoolboy for a little bit.
When did politics start becoming a
sort of career option or a consideration?
They reckon every politician's a failed rock star, don't they? You know, that's what they say, you know. And they also say that politics is show business for ugly people. I mean, that's the other thing. But, do you know, I never would have admitted. I probably wanted to be involved in politics, an MP, but I think this is true of a lot of people from the Northwest. You wouldn't dare say that, would you, at school? I want to be a member of Parliament. You know, people who go to Eton or some public school would say that, wouldn't they? I want to be a lawyer, or I want to be... But whereas we kind of wouldn't voice that, would we? We would kind of keep it inside. So I probably didn't dare admit it until, you know, I was well into my mid-20s before I dared say I want to be an MP. And I think that's kind of the way we are a little bit, isn't it? You know, but once I'd kind of said I wanted to do it, I then really became quite focused on it. And it was, never forget it. I was working in Westminster in the government, actually, the Labour government at the time. And I got a call from somebody at number 10 Downing Street who said to me, I'm not going to give you any help and you're going to have to go and win it on your own. But you need to know that the MP for Lee is stepping down. And I remembered that you're from that area somewhere, aren't you? And I said, yeah. I said, why don't you put yourself forward? So I just remember that. I just went from sort of having sort of a kind of vague idea that I might one day be an MP to sort of then just going completely focused on, yeah, this is the best chance. And to represent a town like that in Parliament, I mean, what an opportunity. So
you went to, did you go to Cambridge Uni?
I did.
And what did you study there? Were you focused on politics then, or was that even...
No. So I studied English at Cambridge University. I'm still waiting to find my knowledge of Chaucer to have a use in politics. I'm not found it yet, but maybe one day it will come. But no, I studied English literature, and I don't look back in any way, in a bad way, about that, because though I did leave a very different world, the Northwest in the 80s, to Cambridge, and it was quite a culture shock, to say the least, you know, to be turning up there. It helped me understand how this country is two countries, effectively. There are people living completely different lives, and it opened my eyes to how this country works and some of the unfair ways in which this country works.
So you spent some time in Westminster, and there was a period there where you fancied leading the Labour Party and maybe ultimately the country, but I know for a fact that eventually you decided you didn't want that. You wanted to get back up north and do some real work with the real people.
You put it very politely there, Clint. Yeah, I lost the leadership twice, right. I think is the honest thing. Yeah, I mean, I stood on a kind of argument where I was saying that Labour was too London-centric, which I believe it is, what has been and still is, and so is Parliament. Mm. And my whole thing always was, you know, this needs to change. You know, you need to have all voice, you know, all parts of the country need to be represented equally in national political structures. And I kind of feel that's the reason why the country voted the way it did at the referendum. You know, we've not lived in a country that has treated all areas the same, have we? You know, some areas get better treatment than others.
Absolutely.
And I think that frustration came out at the referendum. But yeah, that was the moment for me when I lost to Jeremy Corbyn, and you know, and fair play, you know, I mean, he deserved to win that election. But when I did, it made me really think, it's time for me to change. Mm. People outside politics may not understand how people in politics can get disillusioned with it as well. You know, I was as disillusioned with politics as somebody not involved in it, watching it from outside. And I saw all of its shortcomings at very close quarters. Mm. And I just thought, well, yeah, the time is to leave this and try and do something totally different, rebuild something better, closer to home. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Tell us about that Hillsborough moment where you, this coincided with that period where you found yourself in Liverpool and you realised that it was time to not be part of that machine anymore.
Well, you put it very well, but that's kind of what it was like. I mean, it's strange, isn't it, what life can do to you, the way in which it can put you in situations. Well, so I was put in by Gordon Brown as culture secretary in 2008. And it was the year when Liverpool was capital of culture. And I immediately knew what that meant, that I might be in post for the 20th anniversary of Hillsborough. And I was honestly worrying about that from the off, because I knew, well, what can I do? What can I say? You know, how can I justify the lack of help from a Labour government for its own city? You know, it was just one of those things where your personal and your professional life come into just a complete collision. And there's, you know, how do you make sense of it? Mm. So yeah, when I was eventually invited to the 20th anniversary at Anfield, I remember, you know, my blood ran cold, and I just for weeks agonised about whether or not I should go, and if I did go, what should I say? And in the end, my younger brother said to me, he said, you know, look, Andy, he says, go if you're going to do something for them. But if you're not, just don't, you know, stay away. And it was good advice. And at that point, I really resolved to go and do something. But yeah, I mean, I've always said this. If I hadn't been the government minister standing in front of the COP, I'd have been one of those shouting at the government minister. You know, it was like that, and something had to give. And that day was the day when I think the dam broke a bit, really, and people realised that there was something unresolved here.
From day one of starting your work in Manchester, you made it your mission, if you like, to eradicate the city's homelessness and rough sleeping problems. How much progress do you feel like you've made in the last 18 months? And why are you so passionate about this particular cause? Because you are, you're very passionate about it, aren't you?
Completely. Because, you know, we've got to live in a place where we look after everybody, haven't we? And this idea that I had a kind of feeling that somehow it was just being accepted as an inevitability of modern life that, you know, I say for some people to succeed, other people had to sleep in doorways. Well, no, you know, and it was what really kind of came home to me last year was when a young lad I knew from my time as the MP for Lee died in Railway Road in Lee. And I just thought, this is just what is happening here. So I am passionate about it. And I've been bringing everybody together slowly around Greater Manchester, the councils, the voluntary organisations, the churches, and we've really built a movement now of people committed to change. And our goal is to end rough sleeping. And the big change we've made has come quite recently with the launch of what we call A Bed Every Night. So this is a campaign over this winter to give every rough sleeper somewhere to go every night of the week. Mm. And already it's having amazing results. 375 people have been through already. Last weekend, there were about 180 people in the warm who would have been outside before. And we've got about 115 people who've already kind of been in the shelters and now moved through to a fixed address. So right. People are already moving through as well. Amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. And it's a simple thing, Clint, isn't it? You know, we learned this last winter where we didn't do this and we just opened the shelters every night. It went below freezing. If you're in, out and not settled, you can't really do anything else than worry about where your next meal's coming from, you know. So you can't move forward if you're in that position, can you, where you're just kind of bouncing around the streets. But what we found is the minute you do settle people and put them in a place every night and their basic needs have been properly met, then they can start to move forward and think about a positive future. So it's simple, but, you know, quite groundbreaking. No other city is doing this, Clint. No other city. But the message we want to send out is, well, if we can do it, why can't everywhere?
Yep, it's a beautiful thing, Andy. Best of luck over the coming months with that. You're still looking at 2020 to get all this sorted out.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, I've definitely made a rod for my own back, if you like. But this is the thing, you know, I used to hear people in Westminster say, oh, under promise and over deliver. Well, to be honest with you, that wouldn't end rough sleeping. You've got to set a big ambition, haven't you? Yeah. Even though there's a risk that I might eventually be accused of failing to deliver it. Do you know, if we got like three quarters towards it, yeah, it'd be absolutely massive. Yeah. But no, I'm still of the view that there's no reason why we can't end rough sleeping here. You know, we've got a position now where we're effectively trying to do it for the winter, and the challenge is to make it all year round. You know, let's have enough places for everybody to go every night of the week. Obviously, I can't force some people to go into those places, but, you know, I want at least to have enough places open all year round so that we can legitimately say that people don't have to sleep rough if they don't want to.
Yeah. And currently, what are the causes that you're devoting the rest of your passion to? What else is there? The trains, you're doing
well. I was going to say, I was passionate about the trains.
You're shouting about trains.
I am. And that's been the most frustrating thing of this year. Not just for me, I know it's for everybody. You know, the transport system's a mess, isn't it? And the trains particularly. And I kind of feel the biggest challenge I've got as I look to the future is to get this place moving properly and get the transport working for people. Get it integrated properly, the buses and the trams and all of that. And I think that's the biggest single challenge in front of me. I mean, I'm doing what I can, where I can. So, you know, we've made the tram cheaper in the morning. It's £1, you know, it's coming on the tram now. Cut the price of tickets for 16 to 18-year-olds. I'm still looking to bring through a free bus pass for 16 to 18-year-olds. So there's some things I can do straight away. But long term, this transport system needs a complete overhaul. And I'll, you know, be putting plans forward in the new year for that.
Yeah. I imagine it's draining some of this stuff that you're talking to me. I can't imagine a world where I had that on my shoulder. All I've got to do is press play and shout Boon Army a bit.
yeah, I fancy a bit of your life for a bit. Well, that might be good. But it's, you know, there is a lot of pressure. I'm not going to sit here and say I get everything right. Of course I don't, you know, and I don't mind people pointing out to me if they don't agree with what I'm doing or they think I should be doing something and I'm not. And so, you know, all they can know is I am 100% dedicated to what I'm trying to do. I won't get everything right, but it will never be for lack of commitment or effort. I am frustrated at times when people tweet me about the trains and the state of the roads. And, you know, I don't have enough power over those things at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that is frustrating.
Yeah.
But, you know, I will keep working at it. As long as people want me as mayor, I'll be here. And I don't see this as a stepping stone back to Westminster. You know, this is what I want to devote myself to.
Let's talk about family. You married a Dutch girl, didn't you, Marie? How does she like Manchester?
Oh, she loves it. She used to work here herself for a while. Yeah, so no, she loves it here. Yeah. Yeah, she is Dutch, but I don't think would want to live anywhere else, to be honest. She's regularly in and out of town. People probably wouldn't know her. She doesn't behave like the mayoral first lady. She keeps a low profile. I think she was for a while a regular favourite of the Daily Mail, and not in a flattering way. So she keeps her head down these days.
And what about the kids? Are they still teaching about new music?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you and I are DJing, aren't we? Later,
yeah,
and
tonight, yeah.
My son has chipped in with a bit of advice, so giving his dad a bit of street credibility that I don't deserve. But no, Jimmy is massive on his music, and it's been a joy actually to go to gigs with him around the city, because you know he's introduced me to things that I'd kind of become lazy about really, and I've got back into a lot of new music because of him. So yeah, there is nothing he doesn't know. He probably knows more than you, Clint.
Well, we'll see. Send him in here. Compare notes.
Yeah.
On a more serious note, we had a moment back the 5th of May of 2017. You started your new job as the Mayor of Greater Manchester. And just a few days later, 2.5 weeks later, the city was thrown into perhaps its darkest chapter in history. I'm talking about the Manchester United tragedy. And you handled it brilliantly. You handled it impeccably. You give the people of Manchester the strength that they needed through that time, and you're a great leader. Behind all the public activity that went on, all the stuff we saw, how did the events of the 22nd of May 2017 affect you personally?
Well, oh my goodness, I mean, it, in a massive way, Clint. I mean, it's very nice what you said. I mean, you know, I remember, like everybody, hearing the news and just feeling utterly sick to the pit of my stomach, and not knowing at the moment then, I just thought, what do we do? You know, what do I do? How do we respond to this? You know, obviously didn't sleep that night, probably many people didn't. Drove into Manchester about 4:30, 5 o'clock, and went into the building that we've got on Oxford Street and Oxford Road, at the bit nearer the library. And one thing I remember very vividly was the number of people that were in and already there. And that mattered. And as I started to go around the streets, people were coming up to me, sort of saying, right, are you okay? And you know, there was a kind of regard, you know, immediately I felt people behind me, you know, and that's kind of helped me. You know, it wasn't me just deciding on my own. There were people around who, you know, and that's what's great, isn't it, about Greater Manchester, the strength of the relationships, the partnership, the solidarity, it was there and I felt it. And because of that, I think it helped me respond then in the way that I did. And I knew I was, you know, responsible for leading an incredible place, but I really will look back on that day and that moment as a kind of time, and I felt it in a kind of awesome power of this place in terms of the solidarity, the way it, you know, backs people up. It was, yeah, and it, as you say, the darkest of times, and it will remain so. And you know, as we get towards Christmas, we think of the families, those injured, those still recovering. It's, you know, it never gets easier for them, I don't think. All I would say is, you know, we will, you know, this isn't just responding in the moment. I continue to meet the families because, in my view, they're forever a part of Manchester. It's our job to look after them, and we will. And you know, we'll continue to respond in the right way. And in my view, the right way is not to let extremists, terrorists of any kind divide us, make us change who we are, how we live our lives. You know, I thought it was great that we went back out to those big events in the city straight after. Music is the lifeblood of this place. I think not just me, the way everybody responded, Clint, was unbelievable. And really, it was the best response to terrorism, because terrorism is designed to divide. It's designed to create a cycle of violence. And there's a kind of kind of savviness of people here, just, all right, we're not letting you, you know, we're going to do exactly what you don't want us to do, and that is not hate each other, stand together. And that's what Manchester did.
Make the music even louder and keep
correct, and that was wonderful.
Like Richard Ashcroft once said, music is power.
It is, isn't it? And it's raw power. It's emotional power. It's like, you know, you can't capture it through anything else. I can make 100 speeches and not get anywhere near what that one person did when they started up that Don't Look Back in Anger in St. Anne's Square. Yeah. I was there. Anybody who was there will never forget it.
Yeah.
You know, the power of music in those moments far transcends anything that politics or practically any other form of the arts or media can do.
Andy, if I was to ask you who are your favourite humans of Manchester of all time, past or present, who would they be?
Oh my goodness. I mean, that is such a hard question, isn't it? Because the thing about this place is it's people, isn't it? There's just so many people who've done and still do incredible things. If you're forcing me to choose, Clint, I'm going to start with an adopted Mancunian, Vincent Kompany. Obviously means a great deal to a lot of people in this city. Well, not everybody, half of the city.
I think that the other half, I think the red half like him as well.
Yeah, he's moving into that space now, isn't he? But he came forward and said to me that he was prepared to dedicate his testimonial year to the whole campaign against homelessness. And that's a big thing, isn't it, for a Premier League footballer of that stature, captain of his country. He doesn't have to, does he? And doesn't have to put himself out there in that way. But he did it describing what the city meant to him and how he, as someone coming here, felt. And I thought that was just so powerful, actually, you know, in terms of, you know, he felt it was giving back to the city what, you know, it had given to him. And so I'd have Vincent in there. Emmeline Pankhurst, I think in this particular year, you know, we're not short of strong women with opinions, are we, in Manchester? But she was, I think...
Some of us are married to them.
Yeah, me too. But I just think it's right, finally, that she's getting the recognition that she deserves. And, you know, people talk about Millicent Fawcett, who was also involved in the whole campaign for women's votes. But our Emmeline, I think, was the one who kind of really was the kind of the brains behind it, the driving force behind it. And it's going to be quite a moment when the statue is unveiled in St. Peter's Square. And, you know, it's going to be great, that, isn't it? She's going to have a place. You know, Manchester's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not big on statues. You know, if you walk around, there's a few, but it's like that belief, isn't it, in the bee, that you don't over-promote. Everyone's equal and no one's more important than anyone else, and therefore you don't over-promote the individual. So if you look around the city, there's not many statues, but I think that says a great deal about the incredible spirit of Emmeline that she gets her statue. And then the third is a more personal one. People may remember Paul, but the MP for Withenshaw and Sale East, people remember Paul Goggins, lifelong City fan, all round the most wonderful human being I've ever had the privilege to know or to work with, actually. Paul kind of never sought the spotlight. You know, he just didn't do things for publicity, even though he was an MP. He just did the right thing and did it quietly, you know, always speaking up for prisoners, for the dispossessed in one way or another, but also was the lone voice on the contaminated blood issue for a long time. His predecessor, Alf Morris, you know, Alf was a long-standing MP, had championed that cause, and Paul took it up after him and kept it alive when no one else was paying any attention. And yeah, the fact that there's now a public inquiry on that issue is down to Paul, even though he's no longer with us, sadly. But, you know, Paul Goggins, you know, a truly great Mancunian, even though a name that probably not everybody would know.
Final thing, Andy, describe Manchester in three words.
God, that's a hard one, isn't it? That's very, very hard.
Brutal, isn't it? Brutal.
It is a brutal.
Such a big city.
Politician stuck for words here, but yeah. How to describe it? I was going to say best place in the world, but I was just counting them up in my head there, and that's more than than three. So
best place in world,
yeah, best place in world, yeah, and even in a Lee accent, you
that's
can't.
Still
yeah,
four,
yeah.
Best place ever,
yeah. Okay, I'll go with that. Yeah. Thank you. You're in the right job, Clint. You've got a good way with words. Right. I should be able to do it as an English student, but best place ever. Yeah, well, I'll go with that. And I believe that, because what defines a place? You know, it's not all the architecture and the scenery, and it's the people, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, it's absolutely the people. And you can travel the world and you will not find better people than the ones who live right here. Best place ever.
Andy Burnham, thank you for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Thank you, Clint.
That was Andy Burnham. Make sure you join us next week, where I'll be joined by the hitman himself, Ricky Hatton. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are at Humans Excess, and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us. Feel free to leave us a comment. Thanks for listening. See you next week.